Hi, this is Brendan Davis from Bedrock Games and the Bedrock Blog, and I'm here with Kenny, and we are going to be talking about Return of Condor Heroes, Volume 2, Chapters 11 through 15. So this is the second book of Return of Condor Heroes, and it's the 11th through the 15th chapter, which are the first five of that book. And we're just going to go through this chapter by chapter. So the first chapter is Chapter 11, A Pause from Roaming. And so this is one where we sort of resume where the previous book left off, and Yangor is still up on Mount Hua with Master Hong, and he, you know, the last book ended with him pretty much throwing Master Hong down a cliff, and so now we have a number of things that happen, the most important of which is that Ouyang Feng arrives, and he and Master Hong have a duel with each other. And during the course of that duel, they transfer a lot of their martial arts knowledge to Yangor, so he can sort of act as a middleman to test out their kung fu, I believe what the premise was. And more happens in the chapter, because this isn't something where doesn't just neatly end at Mount Hua, but that's sort of the crucial thing that happens. And then Yangor leaves the mountain, and he eventually finds himself reuniting with Guo Jing and Huang Rong at a gathering of heroes. So I don't know. What did you think of this chapter, Kenny? What were your general thoughts?
I really liked it. So there are lots of little things which helped with Yangor's like character development in this chapter there. So first of all, it was the fact that Hong Qigong was testing Yang Guo to see if he was an honorable person, because he was pretending to sleep for 3 days to see if Yang Guo would protect him throughout the 3 days, because there were the five clowns
in this one.
Yeah, the five clowns of somewhere. I can't remember. Five clowns of.
Well, I think aren't
Tibet.
They. Yeah, I think they're Jin Lun's men, right? Aren't they?
Yeah, disciples of Jin Lun Power. And under pressure, Yang Guo still keeps his promise of looking after Hong's Hong Qigong while he sleeps for 3 days, despite the fact that Hong Qigong appears dead on all fronts, right? So yeah, it speaks a little bit about Yang Guo. Like he's mischievous and quick wit, smart and tricky person, shall we say. But once he's promised something, we know that we sort of getting the hint that he follows through with what he said, no matter what it was, as long as he's given his word. So would you think it's fair to say that this is sort of like one of those times where it's sort of highlighted?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's generally, I think these books, these not just Condor Heroes, but Jin Yong in general, he does tend to really like sort of describing the power progression of his characters over the course of the novels. And a lot of times it does feel like it's tied to their behavior. So in this one, I think at all the moments where he is acquiring these abilities, it's because there's some virtue that the masters who are teaching him recognize in him. And so that's what they're responding to. It's a cool chapter, because you're sort of learning about these dazzling techniques that he's learning, which came up in the previous book, but now they're being transmitted at least in part to Yangor. And like you said, it's also sort of highlighting some of his important qualities as a character. And he's an unusual character, because he's like you said, he's unorthodox, but he's also got this, I don't know if you would call it this honorable streak or this, I don't know quite what it is, but it's a virtue. There's some kind of virtue in him that these characters are recognizing, despite his less than orthodox manners and ways.
I'd say it'd be like an integrity of character more than anything else. Like, you can't call him honest, because he lies all the time.
Yeah.
But he has his principles and he sticks to them, and I think that's so. Yeah, and we get more of this throughout the book two, which I think, you know, is very important to sort of distinguish him from his father, I guess. But we won't go into the spoilers on that, I'd say. So another thing which I found interesting for this chapter was, you know, this is continuing on with Yangor's so shall we say fortuitous encounters, or, you know, just general encounters with legends. You know, these people are at the peak of the martial art world, and you know, even now, like, not when they were in their prime, like, they're even more mysterious and powerful now, and it's just meeting them casually. You know, one of them's his stepfather, and now, you know, he's sharing centipedes with Feng Qigong.
Well, one of the things I love about this book is how all the stuff from the past book that was were moments of adventure or excitement suddenly are mythic in quality. And so you have all these things that are looming over, like everything from his father to, you know, these famous battles that happened to these characters that we're now meeting. They're all kind of looming in the background as almost as scenery for Yangor to interact with. And I like that. This in this genre and with this writer in particular, there's no fear of worrying about, you know, whether things are too coincidental. If it adds to the story, it's fine, and it's not a, you know, like he meets a there are a lot of very coincidental moments in this story where he meets people at the right place in the right time. But you don't worry about it because the book, you know, the book doesn't attempt to sort of explain why. You know why that would be so? It just sort of is convenient for the story, and it's sort of accepted. And I find that one of the refreshing things about the genre. Another point about this chapter that's pretty important is Uyung Fung, who was the big villain in the previous book. In this one, he's just kind of a mad, crazy old man. He finally re remembers who he is during that battle with Master Hong, and you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's an interesting moment. It's an interesting way for these legends to die, where they, if I recall, they basically sort of embrace each other joyfully, and fr I think they, I don't know if they freeze to death or what, if they've just expired because they're, you know,
Yeah, I think they probably, you know, they battled intensely for several days, and they might have sustained some internal injuries when Yang Guo was like trying to separate them and stuff, right? I'm not sure if that actually happened, or if it's just my memory
It's
making things up.
no, I don't know. And also there's the added complication of there's TV shows for this, and I sometimes find
Yeah.
my TV show memory and my book memory mix. But I'm pretty sure that they in the book they end with they're both smiling, and they basically are sort of, you know, just kind of dead holding each other. So I don't know, as a it was a really interesting final battle. Like you said, it goes on for like 2 days.
But first, it was the battle between the actual battle between Ouyang Feng and Hong Qigong, like physical battle. And then, when they were no longer able to physically battle, they started to, you know, teach the stances to Yang Guo, like, not without all the sort of the in-depth principles behind the skills, the mantras, shall we say.
Which is an important thing throughout this book, the sort of this difference between like the technique itself and the principles or the four formulas behind it that give you greater understanding of that technique. And one of the things that frequently happens with Yango is he learns one but not the other.
And it's put it together himself. I mean, that was shown in the first book as well, when, yeah, he was taught the mantras to the trans insect internal style and sword play and stuff, but he never learned the physical move, so he was practically useless. But once he learned it, he could sort of integrate it, and, you know, that became one of the key components for him and Shan Nu learning the Jade Heart Maiden style. But yeah, so, you know, the important skills that Yang Guo learns in this chapter. So he learns the physical movements for the dog beating stick, which is the technique of the beggar sect. And while he doesn't really learn anything from Ouyang Feng sort of dismantles the dog beating stick with some staff techniques, which, you know,
I think,
it's
but I
not a
think he
name
taught
set
it.
of.
Didn't he teach him the staff technique? I could have sworn he had.
He taught him the movements for like he this was, you know, so the dog beating stick is a technique in its own self,
yeah.
Named that all the moves are like detailed, like,
yeah.
Whereas this was just, oh, I'm thinking in his head. I mean,
Yeah.
he was like theorizing what he would do to dismantle each technique or counter each technique in an actual combat, and you know, and he had Yang Guo demonstrate it, and then to show Hong Qi Gong that dog beating stick wasn't invincible, that type of thing.
And yeah, it's a very interesting sequel to the story where you have these, again, like, the, you know, characters like Hong Qi Gong, but also this major villain sort of, you know, being almost recast through the eyes of Yang Guo. Everybody's kind of getting you're getting a different point of view on all these characters, and we see that in the coming chapter. We'll get into that because that becomes very important. But after the mountain thing, he leaves. There is mention that he's resentful of the world's customs, which is important in the wake of all this. And he arrives. I think the place is called Jinan. I'm probably pronouncing it incorrectly. And he finds a scabies-ridden horse that's being whipped and treated poorly. So he sort of cares for it and it starts following him. And he sees a group of beggars and also sees two eagles, which we know are sort of the symbols of Huang Rong and Guo Jing. So we know that they're nearby. And he hears that there's a gathering at a temple. And he wants to go tell Huang Rong about the death of Master Hong. So he punches himself in the face a bunch of times and attempts to infiltrate the gathering. And then there's the Hero's Feast, which it gets into more detail in the next chapter, but this is kind of where it begins. So we should probably just kind of wrap those two up together, since they're you know, the end of this chapter and the beginning of next chapter is pretty, they're pretty tied together. What did you think of the Hero's Feast?
I remember sort of like seeing this depiction on TV, and, you know, I really enjoyed that. I mean, I thought it was clever the way, you know, the sort of newbie, like, not his internal energy isn't the greatest, and he isn't the most skillful, because he knows all of these different techniques that are profound in their own way, that he's able to hold his own against, you know, the strongest fighters from Tibet. You know, and also, you know, of course, there were the other heroes at the feast, but I think Yang Guo would stand out the most as, you know, being the youngest and having such breadth of knowledge, which we wouldn't expect, I think.
No, and I think it's also, it is interesting, too, that you do, one of the things I like about these stories is that you really do see the growth of the characters' kung fu over time, and so you kind of have a better, you can almost measure them against other characters to sort of figure out where they're at, and Yang Guo, a lot like Huang Rong, like you said, he sort of relies on his wits a lot, and even with like a little bit of kung fu, he can seem to get a lot out of it. And when he gets there, I think this is one of the, there's a lot of good chapters in what we have for today's discussion, but this is one of the ones that I really like too, and in part it's for the same reason that you mentioned. I really remember the depiction in the first TV show version I ever saw, where you just have that wonderful battle that, and it's almost confusing. There's so many people involved, and you know, they're individual duels, so it's only two people at a time typically, but there's so many of them, and there's so much plot sort of happening around the duels that you know, it almost takes a few viewings or readings for it to really sink in exactly what's going on here. But yeah, so this is the chapter two where he reunites with his Chuanzhen sect masters, and some things start coming to light in the presence of Guo Jing and Huang Rong, who are just discovering that he hasn't been training with the Taoists at all. He's and he basically tries to pretend that he doesn't even really have kung fu, and Huang Rong obviously is suspicious of this. A lot of people are, and so there's this sort of slapstick thing that starts happening where people are trying to test him to figure out if he knows as little kung fu as he's letting on. And so then there's like a little bit of a brief interlude, and we learn that the Hero's Feast is because Huang Rong wants to pass the chief status on to Elder Lu. She's you know, she hasn't really been the active chief anyways. He's pretty much been in charge. So she's going to pass on the dog beating stick techniques, which he needs to know to be chief. But he's not a very capable kung fu practitioner. I mean, I don't think he's terrible, but he's not anywhere near Huang Rong's level, and he's a bit slow. And so,
I think it's just that because he's quite old as well.
Yeah.
From what I remember in the description, and yeah, his memory wasn't great, and the mantra for dog beating stick is quite complicated, and he just couldn't, you know, he couldn't learn it in a couple of hours of recital. And yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, generally speaking, the younger your mind is, the easier you would find to memorize long passages of stuff. There's a scene where Guo Fu and I think the Wu brothers as well as Yang Guo were sort of hiding in a tree nearby while Huang Rong was sort of trying to force this guy to memorize this profound technique. By the end of the whole session, like, he wasn't able to memorize it, but, you know, Yang Guo managed to memorize the whole thing by then. So this is what we mentioned previously about how he's never really taught a technique in its entirety. He learns it in pieces from different people. So now he's already learned all the variations in the movements from Hong Qigong, but now he knows the mantra, the full meaning behind it. Yeah. But it's still not quite the full thing, because as we find out later, you know, there's still lots of applications and how to apply these principles that he's not been taught. It's still sort of like at the 66% level.
Well, they talk about the subtle variations of the technique, and so you could sort of it's these levels of refinement that you almost have to gain through experience and through somebody mentoring you through that process of actually using the techniques. And this is like an interlude moment, but it's very important because here we learn that Huang Rong is pregnant, which becomes very important over the course of the story, but is also just crucial because this really affects her ability to use the martial arts she knows when all of these dire things are happening over the next couple of chapters. And there's also a bit of a reconciliation between Yang Guo and Guo Jing and Huang Rong. And Huang Rong seems to be developing a little bit more respect for Yang Guo and a little bit more trust that he's not as evil as his father. Which is kind of a looming question over the first part of the story. When we get to the Heroes Feast, where, you know, you have all the beggars present, you have a bunch of eminent heroes present, there's Lu is made the leader of Beggar Clan, and everybody spits on him the way that you're supposed to when you become the leader of Beggar Clan.
That's a really strange custom. I guess it's supposed to be one of those things where you need to be taught humility. Just because you're the leader doesn't mean that you are above being a beggar type of thing.
Well, I think Beggar Sect, when they're at their best, that's what they epitomize. They're sort of the, you know, like one of their ways for determining whether they'll even deal with somebody in some of these stories is how well they treat beggars. Do you know what I mean? Like, how well do you treat the lowest of the low in society? And so I think that's a reminder of that, you know, of that idea. That's, you know, because a lot of people that are in beggar sect, they're beggars by choice. You know what I mean? I think they see beggars as more inherently righteous than other people in society. And so it's an interesting initiation rite. It definitely, you know, it sort of reminds me of like a gang initiation, except instead of getting beaten up, people spit on you.
And you get to be the boss at the end.
Yeah, and then you get to be the boss at the end. Yeah. But then, you know, during the feast, the heroes learn that one of Chief Hong's last commands to the beggars is to fend off the Mongols. They decide that they need to select a chief of the Wulin to unite all of the martial heroes, and the Mongols arrive. The Jinlun students, Da Erba and Prince Huodu, arrive, and and they try to basically get the title of Chief of Wulin passed to Jin Lun so that they can completely undermine the Song as the Mongols are preparing to invade, which is an important sort of threat that's sort of hanging over everything as all these things are unfolding. And then that's when we get the series of duels that we talked about, which are staggeringly interesting. And I cannot emphasize enough, it's almost an entire chapter of fighting. Like, it's just a description of fighting, which you would think would be difficult to do and also potentially really boring. Like, it's one thing to watch fights on screen, but you would think it's not as exciting to read about it. But the fights are really engaging. You really get drawn into them. And all of the clever little flourishes that occur throughout them sort of just really hold your attention.
Yeah, so you're right that protracted fight scenes can be quite a dry read sometimes, especially if they're just like move against move against move against move, and that's not interesting. Like, I think most decent authors would not try to write anything like that. What Jin-Yong's done here is like for example, like, take the scholar I can't remember his name now.
Zhu Zilu, is that his name?
Yeah, Zhu Zilu, who was using calligraphy to fight against Prince Hodo. And that was like, because there was so much like information regarding the script he was using, the poetry that he was using. Yeah, that's very different from just saying, oh, and then he stabbed his sword to the right, and then he swung his sword around in a circle, and that's very different and very much more captivating than plain descriptions of sword fights, I'd say.
Well, and there's also a lot of little things going on around the fight too, like and I think the stakes are managed really well. Like, you know that this isn't just some battle. This is, you know, Jin Lun's trying to become master of the Wulin, and if he gains that title today, then that could really crush their will when they have to face the Mongols. So it's
the thing is, like, so this is something that's always sort of bothered me in the series, like the seat of the leader of Wulin, that comes up here, and then also like Heaven Sword Dragon Saber as well, the owner of the Dragon Saber will be the leader of Wulin, and they make it sound like this very powerful position, which it may be, but on what merits is it a powerful position? Like, why would anyone? Yeah, I understand there's a whole, like, the concept of giving face, and this is probably tied to their customs thing, which Yang Guo looks down on, right? Which he probably doesn't see any point in this. Like, well, fine, just let him win, and then we'll have another leader.
Well, him and Zhao Longnu don't care at all about... Zhao Long, I mean, I'm spoiling things, but she gets the title, and she doesn't even care. She's ready to walk away. I think the value of it is, I mean, the martial world is made up of people that are, you know, worth 100 fighters each. Do you know what I mean? They're like the cannons of this day and age. They're the big guns, and so if you're the person who's uniting all of them and pointing them in the right direction, you can use that power to achieve great things. And so I think that's the attraction of being master of the Wulin.
I think this is also another thing which these people in Wulin tend to get a very big head, shall we say. So take all the Orthodox sects, for example. They believe that because, you know, they have a long heritage and that they have decent martial arts, they should get, what they say should be truth. And to some extent, I think that's what the sort of the leader of Wulin position is like as well. It's because, because I am the most capable, everybody should listen to me type of thing. When in reality, people could just be like, well, you're not very charismatic, you're very good at kung fu, and you might have the ability, but I don't really want to follow you, so goodbye, I'll just do my own thing somewhere else.
That's definitely one way to look at it, and that's probably how we would look at it, but I think another way to look at it is, you live in this world where these powerful martial heroes exist. You know, they're almost superheroes, and who are you going to follow? Are you going to follow the guy who's like got the right moral compass, but he doesn't have the the physical and mental ability to win this martial contest and therefore hold the title? Or are you going to follow somebody who can who can actually fend off your enemies? And so I think that's a big part of it. It's almost like if you take the conceits of the setting, you see that people have to sort of they have to follow people that rise by merit and have the kung fu to stand on their own two feet without being toppled by the likes of Jin Lun. The downside of that is Jin Lun can just become Master of the Wulin, and then it's but the other thing is it's kind of like it's kind of it, they have that rule, but then they're also taking every effort they can to make sure he doesn't become master of the Wulin. So, you know, as much as they've sort of set these ground rules for what determines who becomes master of the Wulin at this gathering, they clearly don't want if it produces a person they're unhappy with, they don't want to have it seems that they don't want to have to abide by it.
Yeah, and that's just sort of the hypocrisy of the so-called orthodox people, isn't it? It's just like that's always present in Jin Yong's novels. It's just like, well, the orthodoxy people are so strict and unyielding, but yet when it comes to against their own interests, then they're suddenly just reads in the wind type of thing. Oh no, we can't have this. And they try to worm their way out of it. I would have been perfectly happy if they kept to if in this scene, for example, if Jin Lun had won, for example, and it would have been interesting to see what the sort of the fallout of that would have been. It's just not that, it would have been just like a di interesting different perspective of what happens if Yang Guo and Shen Longnu weren't there to save the day type of thing, because the whole the day was literally saved by Yang Guo and Shen Longnu being present at the scene. So if they weren't there, how different would it have been?
I mean, I think what would have probably happened is Huang Rong would have had to have stepped up and fought, and you know, and it might not have ended. I mean, I think the threat for her, I think what they're trying to say in the chapter is that if she exerts herself and fights, then she might lose the child. I think that's the danger that she's in. Or Guo Jing would have had to do something, but I don't know. I mean, you know, it's hard to say, but I think you're right. I think they kind of come in and save the day. And this is kind of getting into the next chapter because Zhao Longnu arrives and her and Yang Guo sort of reunite and the world just melts away around them. They're just sort of they're all that exists is their love for each other. And so then that brings us into chapter 13, which in this translation is titled The Chancellor of the Wulin. I usually think of it as the Chief of the Wulin or Master of the Wulin, but and then you know that's when we continue to have this battle over the title of Master of the Wulin. And at this point, I think Jin Lun eventually gets involved and starts fighting directly, but just prior to that.
Yeah, there's the amusing fight between what was his name? The Daraba and Yang Guo. That's that was an interesting one. So yeah, and this is where we sort of get a better glimpse at the cunning of Yang Guo as well. Like he doesn't speak, like so what happens is Daraba is like saying something to Yang Guo in Tibetan.
Yeah, I think I don't know what the language is, but
I'm trying to. In the Tibetan language, and Yang Guo sort of like parrots it back at him. Daraba obviously isn't very he isn't the sharpest tool in the shed, shall we say? Yeah, he's oh my god, you're the first generation disciple of Jin Nim Fa Wong too. That must mean you're my senior brother who died like 70 years ago and reincarnated.
And it's just funny how his respect for Yangor grows over the course of this chapter and the next as he just increasingly is having this confirmed that, oh my God, this guy is the reincarnation of my senior disciple. And oh, he's even like at one point down the road when Yangor is parroting him back, he mistakes what Yangor is saying for him kind of like giving him a certain measure of respect, and so it's like it even deepens it further, and it seems to be driving Jin Lun crazy, who understands what's going on, and Huang Rong also understands essentially what's going on, watching from the sidelines. It's kind of interesting to see that she and Yang Guo really match, like they really have a similar temperament. Yeah, I would say a similar temperament and smarts, and so. You know, it's just sort of a, you know, I don't know, but like you said, the, there's the battle between D'Urba and Yango, which results in D'Urba not wanting to fight Yango because he thinks he's his senior disciple. And also how Yango gets drawn into that battle where Yango doesn't even care about this fight. He's just talking to Xiaolong Nu and, an oar, they describe it as an oar in this translation. That's you know, part of the battle gets broken or sent out of the ring, and I think it hits Xiaolong Nu in the foot or something, and Yang Guo just, you know, can't have that, so he gets involved. But eventually it becomes a battle between Xiaolong Nu and Jin Lun, and that's when we see Jin Lun's golden wheels, which are pretty impressive. And there's a whole, you know, again, like I said, this whole chapter is very convoluted with the fighting. There's a lot of stuff going on. And
Jin Lun, strategy as well between the duels is, yeah, like they were quoting historical figures and saying how you should send your strongest against their second strongest and your second strongest against their third strongest, and then just throw the match against the strongest one so that you win 2 out of 3.
Yeah, and also the whole thing when Jin Lun and Xiaolong Nu fight, he basically asks her to withstand 10 of his stances, which is kind of this very typical thing you have in these stories where, you know, if you can withstand 3 of my stances, then, you know, I'll let you pass or something to that effect. And Yang Guo is pestering him the whole time, like overcounting, like every move he takes, he's counting, even if it's not like a proper stance, even if he's just like getting into position or reacting. But it eventually, the fight does end with Gua Jing's hurting Jin Lun with his palms, and Jin Lun having to circulate his ki to recover, and the Mongolians leave, they depart. I thought 13 was an interesting chapter. Again, I don't know if we're quite doing it justice, because this is one that, like, if you've ever seen the shows, they really tend to emphasize this one because it plays so great on the screen. But for me, the key moment is D'Urba mistaking Yang Guo for his senior student, which pays so many dividends down the road. So the next chapter is chapter 14, Defending Against Custom and Tradition. And this is where they declare Xiaolong Nu the leader of the Wulin, and she doesn't really want the title. And it's also where people learn that Xiaolong Nu and Yang Guo are more than just master and student. They're lovers, and Zhao Zhijing basically tells everybody what he saw when they were practicing kung fu naked in the field together, and so there's this whole thing. So this sort of leads to the next separation between Xiaolong Nu and Yang Guo, because Xiaolong Nu is convinced by Huang Rong that Yang Guo will get bored if he's forced to live in a cave with her, and this plants a seed of doubt that results in her eventually leaving, and once again Yang Guo is sort of on his own.
And not just that too, so yeah, I think Hong was also saying something along the lines of, like, if Yang Guo, even if you were to leave the tomb with Yang Guo, like, he would be looked down on by the rest of the world because of this foul relationship type of thing.
But, and, but, But that didn't seem to bother Xiao Longnu too much. I don't think she got
Yeah,
too.
I don't think she would be bothered if it was against her, because it was against Yang Guo. I think that's also part of the thing, where she was concerned. She's not concerned about herself at all when it comes to Yang Guo. It's like, it's only what's going to affect him, like what's best for him. Like, she was thinking like, oh, well, you know. So on one hand, like, if they were to leave the tomb, then Yang Guo would have no place in society. Which she doesn't want, and you know, and if she doesn't leave the tomb, then she's worried that he's gonna get bored. So like this sort of I think this sort of shows just how deep the caring that Xiao Longnu has for Yang Guo is. Like, everything that she thinks of is from his perspective and what's best for him.
She's also getting a lot more emotional, because when we first meet her in the ancient tomb, her whole style is built around not giving into emotion and sort of, you know, she isn't even afraid of death. To her, death is just something that happens, and she doesn't really have an emotional reaction to the idea. But now she's getting very emotional around the thought of not being able to be with Yang Guo, or Yang Guo getting sick of her, or Yang Guo being unhappy. And also this is in this chapter, you know, there's another fight with Jin Lun at the restaurant. I think it's a restaurant or an inn. And this is where Xiao Longnu and Yang Guo start to really learn how to bring their movements in sync, and they have a number of insights into improving their martial arts. And we also kind of learn that the purpose of Jade Maiden swordplay is meant to be complementary with Chuan Zensek's style, and that the two fighters are really supposed to be protecting each other. It's like a protective style, and it's an expression of the founder's love for the founder of Chuan Zensek. So
yeah, I think it's sort of where we get the realization from Yang Guo that actually, I'm not sure if it was vocalized or if it was just like in the prose that mentions that about the founder of Ancient Tomb Sect wanting to actually fight alongside. So despite the fact that all of her techniques counter Transcendsex techniques, like one on one type of thing, what she actually wants is to use this to cover the gaps in the techniques so they can fight together flawlessly.
Yeah,
it's the whole idea. But I don't remember if this was something realized, or if they were just thinking, oh, actually this works.
Well, in this translation, I found it a little bit difficult to tell, because I wasn't always sure if it was just sort of describing background, or if that was something that Yang Guo was aware of.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's clearly related, and it's exactly like you're saying. Like, they, you know, the two styles are, one of them is meant, like, you, like if one of them uses the Chuan Zen style, one of them uses the Jade Maiden style, then those two, they're like perfect complements of each other. And it's kind of cool. It's like a really interesting concept, and again, they have that fight, and then afterwards, you know, again, this is also getting into the theme of the idea that you know, Xiao Longnu and Yang Guo are master and student. They're not supposed to be in a relationship. This is sort of like a Confucian society where that relationship is considered like the relationship of like of a parent to a child, and so it's almost incestuous for them to be doing that. And Huang Rong learns that you know, they want to stay together in the same room, and Xiao Longnu is mad that she wants her to sleep in a separate room from Yang Guo. But then when they do end up in the same room together, they just go back to their old sleeping pattern of Xiao Longnu sleeping on a rope and him sleeping in the bed. And Huang Rong is a little bit surprised to discover they still kind of have like an innocent relationship, even if they are in love. They haven't really, you know, it hasn't become physical. And then in the morning, Xiao Longnu leaves. And then later on, towards the end of the chapter, Yang Guo goes to find her, and then he encounters Jin Lun fighting Huang Rong yet again, because he's trying to he's basically trying to abduct her, and so there's this big battle between Jin Lun, Huang Rong, the Wu brothers, and I think Guo Fu is there too, and she's also, I think, in this battle, was this the one where Huang Rong is using the rock formations that are kind of based on the Peach Blossom Island formations?
Yeah.
And this is important because this is where, during the battle, Huang Rong realizes that she can teach Yang Guo the subtle variations of the dog beating stick, and that can help him fend off Jin Lun. So, you know, and that gets us into the next chapter, which is chapter 15, The Disciples of Eastern Heretic, which is a very intriguing title and one of my favorite chapters that we covered this time around. In this chapter, we get the rest of that fight, and a mysterious woman with a mask, I think she's dressed in a green-blue dress or something, shows up and helps them fend off Jin Lun. And Yang Guo ends up leaving with her because he's greatly wounded by the battle, and she takes him to this thatched house in the wilderness. And he discovers that, number one, she's someone that he's met before from earlier in the novel. And she's the one of the girls from the very beginning of the story that were when the Liu family was attacked by Li Mochu. And the other girl, I think, what's her name? Liu...
Wushang.
Liu Wushang is also living at the house. And they're all... and so he recovers there, and they have to deal with the threat of Li Mochu during this chapter, but he also gets to meet Huang Yaoshi for the first time and learn some techniques from him. And again, then, you know, the chapter ends with them being sort of chased by Li Mochu and trying to create that giant pair of scissors to counter her.
I think you missed that one very important point from this chapter. The most important, in my opinion, is learning the fact that his father was murdered by someone.
So, well, you know what? I didn't just forget it this chapter. I forgot it in the previous chapter too, because in one of the earlier chapters at the Hero's Feast, that's when he kind of learns that his father dies, you know, in this big battle. And, you know, he's starting to get sort of an image of what's going on. And then this chapter, there's what's her name, Shagu, the crazy girl from Legend of Condor Heroes. She's the disciple of Huang Yaoshi, and she's crazy, but she basically mistakes Yang Guo for the ghost of Yang Kang, and then he starts piecing things together, and he realizes that she knows who killed his father, and so he gets her to. She doesn't say explicitly who it is, but she says Auntie killed Yang Kang, and so. Now we're starting to get that seed planted in Yang Guo that'll become very important over the course of the story, where he has to grapple with the knowledge that his father was killed sort of indirectly by Huang Rong. That'll become important down the road. But yeah, that was probably the most important thing this chapter. So I don't know. What did you think of this chapter?
Well, it was a very jam-packed chapter, though, to be honest. Like, lots of things happened here. I mean, he learns kung fu from Huang Yaoshi, and picks up a bit of formation stuff there, and discovers the other disciple of the Eastern Heretic, the blacksmith there.
Oh, Feng Mo Feng. Yeah. That's my favorite scene. That is so cinematic, everything that's going on in that moment. So we'll talk about all the stuff before, but I just got to talk about this scene where Huang Yaoshi has left already, and they're on their own, and they have to fend off Li Mochu, who has been hiding in the woods and chasing them. And so they go to this town to find a blacksmith, and Yang Guo has this brilliant idea of making a giant pair of scissors to cut her fly whisk tethers. And they meet this blacksmith, and Li Mochu, there's a lot of stuff that's very interesting about her this chapter, but she's really pissed off at Huang Yaoshi because he kind of fended her off, and she knows she can't beat him. So she's going around saying that Huang Yaoshi is teaming up five against one and is the laughing stock of the Zhang Hu. And she's really sort of going a little bit crazy attacking Huang Yaoshi's character, but also his disciples. And little does she know, this blacksmith is one of his crippled disciples from Legend of Condor Heroes. He ended up crippling all of his disciples when Mei Chao Feng and her husband stole the Nine Yin Manual from him. But they all still remained fairly loyal. And he ended up regretting, you know, crippling them like that. And so at one point, Li Mocho, I think she throws a note, or she pastes a note to the pillar, belittling the disciples of Huang Yaoshi. And as he's making these scissors, you know, he's just going on saying, you know, the disciples of Huang Yaoshi can move heaven and earth. And then he starts describing each of them and, you know, and saying who they are. But then as he does that, she's sort of commenting. And so he gets to Bronze Corpse, and she's like, oh, he was killed by a 6-year-old boy. He's nothing. And it's so funny because that's what really happened. And so we're getting sort of, you know, like Li Mochu, like Yangor, is sort of looking at this from a different point of view, and we're sort of getting her perspective on it. And she has very little respect for these figures who, if you read the prior book, you would know, you know, sure, Bronze Corpse was killed by Yangor when he was, you know, when he was just a boy, but he was still a very ferocious figure. He was not somebody that you would to be trifled with. And it just, Guo Jing got lucky and stabbed him in the belly. So, and then when the blacksmith finds out that Mei Chao Feng was killed, I think that's when he actually starts to weep, and there are these teardrops land on the forge and sizzle.
Yeah.
And so it's just this great, I don't know, I just really love that scene. And that's
this is the same, the fight scene also happens there between the blacksmith, between Feng and Blacksmith Feng and Nemo Cho is in this chapter as well, right?
This is right before that. The next chapter is when that comes out. So this is like right up. So this is unlike a lot of the chapters. This isn't a chapter that sort of ends in the middle of a fight. This one ends before the fight really starts.
So we can't say anything about the fight, but look forward to it next time. It was awesome.
Yeah, and there were plenty of fights this chapter. We have this whole thing where Li Mochu, she's this looming threat, and she ends up putting her palm prints on the house, and Yangor and the girls all, you know, realize that she kills before the light of day. Is that the
light of
day? So they know. So she's very dramatic, and the girl. The girl that rescued them, that was wearing sort of, at first he thinks she's sort of the, you know, this ugly girl. It turns out she's wearing a mask. Her name is Cheng Ying, and she plays the flute and plays, I think, the guzheng.
I just want to point out as well, like, in Wuxia novels, there is never an exceptionally ugly girl who is not faking it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would say maybe in a Gulong story, you'll get some of it. You'll get it. But
some people are actually ugly. Yeah. But not in Jin Yong novels.
What's also funny about Jin Yong novels is he really, like, he has like solid metrics for how attractive people are. And so you know exactly, like, they're attractive, but not more attractive than this person. But they are more attractive than this other person, and then he sort of has this hierarchy of beauty. Yeah. Yeah. But when Li Mochu finally arrives, she's playing this music, and I think it might actually be the poem from the start of the story. I can't remember, but it's a moving song, and Li Mochu starts weeping, and I think that's number one. It's really sort of interesting that she starts crying, you know, at the sound of this song that reminds her of her former lover. But then she starts singing, and it's just this really, you know, it's very unexpected that they're just going to, you know, that you have like a, and music is very easy to kind of weave in wuxia, but I feel this is particularly well done where Li Mochu's song starts overpowering, powering her, Cheng Ying's song. And I think Cheng Ying starts on the flute, but then kind of has to retreat to the guzheng, and then Li Mochu crashes through the wall, and eventually, if I recall, Huang Yaoshi returns and helps sort of fend her away.
Yeah, because I think it was like this sort of it was quite a tense fight scene actually. I think where Cheng Ying was like playing the guzheng, but Li Mochu's internal energy was making her break the strings one by one, and she was down to like the last string before Huang Yaoshi comes up and defeats Li Mochu using the last string of the guzheng.
Well, and I mean, there's a line earlier in the story about music when they're talking about Zhao Longnu, and they talk about how how music is pleasant to the ear, but noise is disquieting to the heart or something like that. And that's kind of seems to be what's going on here, is that the music is it's weaponized music. It's like Huang Yaoxi's flute in The Legend of Condor Heroes, where you can he can destroy a person with his music. And so I don't know, it's cool that they that you can have a scene like this. And so then Huang Yaoxi ends up healing Yang Guo, and they end up really hitting it off very well. And I think this is one of the most interesting parts of the chapter and of the story in general, when they meet, because the thing that Huang Yaoxi finds appealing about Yang Guo is his unorthodox nature. And so there's sort of this moment I where they're having a conversation, I think over the course of many days, and he says to Yang Guo, I hear that you want to marry your master. And he's sort of shocked by it, like everybody else, but he's also a little bit in awe of Yang Guo's boldness and just his willingness to be like, yeah, no, that's what I want to do. And
I think he prides himself on being the heretic, right? And
yeah.
like as someone who's unorthodox, who does things in strange ways, and it's like, wow, I didn't think of marrying my master.
Yeah.
So more like impressed that he went to that extent of being a heretic, and that even he himself could not hope to match.
Yeah, because Huang Yaoxi is one of these guys who like just really does not like, he doesn't like customs and rules, and he just does what he wants to do. And so it's just it's a very cool thing to have these characters paired. And he actually asks Yang Guo to be a student, and Yang Guo doesn't want to become his student. And he finally agrees that he'll be Huang Yaoxi's disciple when he's fighting Li Mochu, and like only when he's fighting Li Mochu. I think to get revenge for the her insulting his reputation. And so it's a I don't know, I thought it was a very interesting chapter, a lot of fun. We probably left out a lot of stuff, but
And I think there's one thing that so the I think it was mentioned in the chapter actually, the sort of the relationship between Zhao Bortong and Guo Jing. They were on like different levels of seniority, but they became brothers in Legends of the Condor Hero. And I think what Kang actually mentioned it here is that I'm not like Zhao Bortong, and
Oh
that in that I can't become brothers with you.
yeah, he kind of gets, but then he kind of agrees to it, right? Then he's like, okay, like yeah, we can
We
be,
can be friends, but I
yeah.
can't be we can't be brothers.
But yeah, no, and it is funny how much of that mirroring goes on in this story with the previous story. Like, there definitely is a lot of that kind of like a lot of the stuff that Yang Guo is encountering are similar to things that Guo Jing encountered. But they're from a completely different angle. Like, and so but anyways, they Huang Yaoxi does teach him a couple of his techniques. I think he teaches him the jade flute sword play, and he teaches him his finger flick technique. I think in this one they called it the divine finger flick. And so again, you kind of get to see sort of this growth of Yang Guo's power. And again, it's interesting that it's sort of, it's always about sort of these teachers finding something that they respect in him or that they like about him, and then agreeing to teach him one of their techniques. And in this case, I think he does it when Yang Guo, he just decides to go out and kill Li Mochu, and he stops him and he teaches him the techniques. And he's like, well, I'll teach you these techniques, but it's going to take you 3 years to master them. So wait 3 years before taking on Li Mochu. It's kind of, and again, Huang Yaoxi isn't a sentimental type of guy, so it's a little, there's no real direct evidence of this in the text, but I feel like he's doing it to help protect Yang Guo from going off and getting killed, fighting Li Mocho. So yeah, I don't know, did you have any other thoughts on this chapter before we head out?
No, I think this is a very important chapter for the story. Just on the how find find more unraveling about the history of Yang Guo's father, and it sort of deepens the mystery of like, oh, what happened? Like, if you haven't read Legends of the Condor Hero, you wouldn't really you wouldn't know what everything's referring to, but you just from the chapter alone, you get the feeling that there is definitely more that's going on. And I think if I sort of put on the my oblivious hat, I would think that perhaps Huang Rong was the one who actually did kill Yang Kang in the previous story, and that Guo Jing had no idea about all of this because he is an innocent and simple man. Like he's telling the truth the whole time. But Huang Rong was the one who's hiding all the secrets because she's that type of character, and that Yang Guo is gonna, somewhere down the line have his revenge against both Guo Jing and Huang Rong, and at the last moment there'll be a tragic finding out that it was Huang Rong lying the whole time, and Guo Jing is gonna die in despair, or just something along those lines, right?
No, you don't
Not
know.
sure.
And it really does. This is where it really kind of cranks up. It feels like it's really starting to get like all of the stuff that's been built up in the first volume is really starting to go someplace very interesting. And I think that's one of the most harrowing parts of this story is wondering how he's going to handle the information that he's getting over his father's death. And like you said, if you jumped in at the middle, not knowing Legend of Condor Heroes, you'd really be kind of on the edge of your seat. But yeah, I don't know. I think that this is a number one. This is something where if you don't want to, you don't like reading or you don't want to read the story, you can just go and watch the TV show, and as long as you get one that's a good adaptation, you'll get the general storyline. But you can find this story online. Like I said, we have the Noodles translation. There's different translations of it available, and I think I'm sure there's just Google "Return of Condor Heroes" translation. I'm sure you'll find one. But I highly recommend reading it because it's a very rewarding read. And if you read a story like this, it pays off when you watch these kinds of martial arts movies and television shows. It really can add a lot. We're doing Brave Archer on our podcast. We're gonna start doing them, I believe, the week after next is when we're or maybe it's
I
next
think
week.
it's actually next week. The
Next
next week will
week.
be the first episode,
Okay.
the first episode of Brave
Oh
Archer.
yeah, 'cause we're doing them for February, right? So we're sort
Yeah.
of doing like a love month. Themed around Valentine's Day, and so we decided to do all three the first three of the Brave Archer movies, and so if you watch a film like that, reading the source material really adds to it. So I don't know, did you have anything you want to add, or are you all set?
Yeah, it's just like speaking of sort of like a love month, like so this whole trilogy of Legends of Condor Hero, Return of Condor Hero, and Heaven Sword, Dragon Saber, I think in my opinion at the heart are all romance stories, sort of before their wuxia stories. And that makes sense. Like
Yeah.
obviously it's all very interwoven, but the romance is very important throughout each of the stories, in terms of how the story plays out and the motivations of the characters. So and there's depictions of different types of romance, as which is quite interesting. So yeah, if you do check out the Brave Archer movie, or read Legends of the Condor Hero, you'll get a very different flavor of love between Guo Jing and Huang Rong versus Yang Guo and Shan Longlu.
And then and it, and like you said, even in like Heaven Sword, Dragon Saber, it's a it's a theme. So I mean, like I kind of I actually kind of pref that's like my favorite of the if you're just talking about the love stories, I would say my favorite is the love story stories in Heaven Sword, Dragon Saber, because it gets so complicated. But yeah, again, like Kenny was saying, you can get these online. And the series are out. You can and they make like one or two every decade. So you can always find like an era that suits you. Just be aware that some of the more recent ones have taken a lot of liberties with the storyline. If you watch like the 2014 Return of Condor Heroes or the 2008 Legend of Condor Heroes, those take substantial liberties. And so in the 2008 Legend of Condor Heroes, they actually try to redeem Yang Kang in that one. And so if you watch that one and then you watch like a version of Return of Condor Heroes that's true to the story, it makes no sense. So make sure you at least watch adaptations that line up. But not that, you know, and I actually enjoyed the 2008 Legend of Condor Heroes, but it just, it's one that you need to be aware of the changes or you'll be sort of, you'll misunderstand sort of the story. So all right, so we're gonna go and we're gonna be back next week with Brave Archer, and then we'll, you know, continue on the whole month with Brave Archer. I apologize if we haven't had any episodes up lately. It was actually just due to me needing to get my computer repaired, so we had to take about 5 or 6 days off, and so we're gonna be back full swing now. And all right, so we will see you next week with Brave Archer.